CEO of the free world now. Build your walls up high and wide. Make it rain to keep them out. That won't change what we are inside. Pick the fruit of your labor. Cultivate, plant your seeds now and watch them grow. Man, I'll holler at you later. Let you find out what you're made of. Just saying, is that the look of freedom? No. Is that the sound of freedom?
Good morning. My name is Layla Kanan, and you're listening to One Land, Many Voices on KBOO Portland 90.7. On today's show, to help us understand the actions of the Israeli government in the struggle for Palestinian freedom, I'm interviewing peace activist Miko Peled. He was born and raised in Israel and is the son of a former IDF general and the grandson of one of the founding fathers of Israel. He's the author of two books, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. You know, I grew up listening to Miko speak out about these issues, and I've always admired how, on his own accord, he went from believing Israel could do no harm to being one of the biggest advocates for Palestine. In his book, The General's Son, the author Alice Walker wrote the foreword, and in it is a poem she wrote that was inspired by watching a video of home demolitions and house grabbing of Palestinian homes by Israeli settlers. Walker explains that, quote, "It was a shock to witness the jubilation of the conquerors while installing the Israeli flag on the roof, a house whose just evicted inhabitants huddled in the street below," unquote. The poem is called Hope. Hope never to covet the neighbor's house with the fragrant garden from which a family has been driven by your soldiers. Mother, father, grandparents, the toddler and the dog now homeless, huddled, holding on to each other, stunned and friendless beneath you in the street, sitting on cobblestones as if on the sofas inside that you have decided to clean, recover, and keep. Hope never to say yes to their misery. Hope never to gaze down into their faces from what used to be their rooftop. Hope never to believe this robbery will make you a better citizen of your new country as you unfurl and wave its recent flag that has been given to assure you of this impossibility. Now we have Miko Peled. Miko, thank you for joining us.
We are the sound of freedom. We are the look of freedom. We are the sound of freedom. We are the look of freedom.
Now we have Miko Peled. Miko, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So just to start us off, could you give us a little information on your background, what you grew up believing, and what changed your outlook?
Well, I, as the title of my first book, The General's Son, suggests, I'm the son of an Israeli general. So obviously I grew up with a very patriotic Israeli Zionist upbringing and education. But then, as the subtitle of the book, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, suggests, at a certain point in my life, I decided to take the journey, which, if anybody knows anything about Palestine, is clearly is not a not a very long journey because it's a small country. But I took the journey as an Israeli into Palestine. And that is significant because it forced me, and hopefully forces the reader or anybody who sees it, to come to terms with what does it mean to be an Israeli? What is Palestine? Where is Palestine? Where is Israel? And these are all questions that I think are crucially important and are not really discussed enough. So basically, it was a privileged guy from the privileged sphere, from the sphere of the occupier and the settler, where everything is green and nice and the roads are paved and you have plenty of water and so forth and it's completely safe, to the sphere of the other, the sphere of the occupied, the sphere of the oppressed, the, you know, where the roads are not paved, where there's no regular flow of water, where things are kind of dusty and messy and so forth. And that journey is really more of a psychological, political journey than really a long physical journey. But it's a journey that very few people actually take. And so having taken that journey was a big step, you know, for me and for, you know, for anybody who comes from my background.
Right, of course. So talking about the, you know, patriotism that your father has for Israel, you know, you talk about in your book, he has a lot of love and adoration, but, you know, he also is very pro-Palestinian and is a peace activist. So how exactly did your father justify, you know, what seems to me like a clear contradiction, given that Israel as a country is built on stolen Palestinian land and depends on the ongoing disenfranchisement of Palestine? Do you think you could explain that a little bit?
Yeah, it's a typical, you know, it's a typical liberal Zionist or liberal occupier. He thought that in order to maintain the accomplishments of 1948, which was the establishment of the State of Israel had to make some concessions to the Palestinians. And those concessions, he felt, within the context of what we know today as the so-called two-state solution, where the Palestinians would be allowed to establish a small state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and Israel will maintain its, you know, accomplishments, its existence, you know, close to 80% of Palestine, the majority of Palestine. Mm-hmm. That was acceptable. And the basic thinking is that we don't look at the past. You know, we don't look at 1948. We look into the future. The State of Israel is a given, and that's the way it is. And if Palestinians are willing to recognize it, then the State of Israel is willing to allow them to establish a small independent state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And he felt that this was the only way to guarantee a Jewish state, and he was right. It was really the only way to guarantee a Jewish state. So that was his thinking, and that was the, you know, that was what motivated him to do what he did. And he was a Zionist through and through, and this whole concept of the two-state solution, of course, is a Zionist concept.
Right. So I guess on a personal level, I've been struggling a little bit with making the distinction between Israelis and the Israeli government. You know, to me as a Palestinian, it's hard to separate the two. The Israeli people are the ones, you know, taking over and living on Palestinian land, not just the Israeli government. You know, with the same rationale, Native Americans here could view me the same way. So I guess I'm wondering how I can reason with this and make the distinction between the two, you know, people versus government.
You don't need to make that distinction because the Israelis vote for these governments. Mm-hmm. For Israeli Jews, Israel is a perfectly democratic state. And Israeli Jews for seven decades have been voting for the very governments who have been dispossessing and killing Palestinians. And of course, Israelis are the ones who serve in the military. And like you said, Israelis are the ones who are benefiting from the dispossession and the forced exile and the killing of Palestinians. So there is no distinction. Israeli society is responsible. The Israeli government is just the one carrying this out and actually making it happen through the, you know, the structure and the bureaucracy of a state. But there is no distinction here. The problem is Israeli society and the Israeli people. The crimes are being made by them, for them, and by people who they elected. Just to maybe one more sentence, you know, you're talking about Native Americans. You're right about this as well. But the problem is that the indigenous people of America have been brought to a point where they really, their existence is of no significance to anyone. Their oppression and their killing and the abuse that they is still going on, but they are so small and so weak that they have no recourse. Palestinians are not, thankfully, been brought to that stage, and change is still possible in Palestine.
Mm-hmm. I guess I don't know. It's just this internal battle that I've been having. Like, it doesn't feel justifiable to be angry at a child who was born in Israel.
Well, it's not about the child.
Yeah.
You know, a child, of course, the child, you're right, but it's about society. Mm-hmm. It's about the people. It's about Israel as a state and the Israelis as a people and as a society, which is the problem. You know, if children were not given racist education, then they would not end up being racist and doing the terrible things that they do.
Mm-hmm. So on a kind of separate note, people who support Israel say that it provides more rights for women and for the LGBTQ+ community than other countries in the Middle East. Can you explain how this is both a false claim and one that's used as propaganda by Israel to promote its military agenda?
Well, what Israel did very effectively is create two separate realities within Palestine. You've got the reality which I came from, which is the privileged sphere, the oppressor's sphere, the colonizer's sphere, within that sphere, it's true. Within that sphere, it's a very liberal, very democratic, women's rights, gay rights. I mean, all these different issues are issues that are discussed, that are, you know, openly discussed and so forth. And the other sphere is the sphere that Israel tries to hide, where there is this brutal oppression and where the lives of the people don't matter and where children are detained and killed and tortured. The dark side, which is the side where the Palestinians live. So Israel has got these two sides, and you know that's why it is a classic apartheid state, because not only do people live under different sets of laws, they live in an entirely different reality and segregated, completely segregated from each other. So Israel can make the claim that within Israel, you know, certain minorities and certain groups have more rights than they do in Arab countries, but that doesn't mean anything. Because what Israel, the way Israel treats a Palestinian is the way a dark dictatorship treats its people. The only people who are privileged and live within a democracy are Israeli Jews within these two realities. It exists within these two realities.
Right. And so I guess to talk about the different rights that people have, in July of this past year, a controversial nation state law was passed with constitutional status, even though Israel doesn't have a constitution. This new law says that Israel is the national home of the Israeli people with Jerusalem as the capital, and it declares Hebrew the national language, which essentially denies the existence of the over 1.5 million Palestinians who live in Israel and hold Israeli citizenship. So what do you see as the main impact of this law?
The main impact of the law, if you're looking at it from a legal perspective, is that it can't be challenged in court. So whereas in the past, Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, if they wanted to go to court against a racist law and challenge a racist law or a racist reality, a racist policy, they could do that. They, over 95% of the cases, they would lose. They lost because the courts are, you know, work with the government and with, you know, they're all Zionist courts. But they could. Now that it's constitutional, and you're right, there is no constitution, but as a basic law, it's regarded as constitutional. They can't even challenge this in court. The other reason for this law is that this is something that Benjamin Netanyahu wanted, you know, because he's the kind of guy that has to jump up and down all day, and this is my country, this is my country, this is my language, this is my language. Of course, the question that I was asked is, you know, why do they need this law if it's so obvious that this is their country and the language is their language? You don't see Palestinians needing a nation state law. Palestinians know that Arabic is their national language, and Palestinians know that Palestine is their country. So I think it comes from a very deep sense of insecurity.
Yeah, I mean, security is at the forefront of every action of the Israeli government. You know, it's always about security and securing the land.
Exactly, because, and this is too, but really what it stems from is this deep sense of insecurity. Why would a country with such a massive army be worried about a Palestinian kid carrying a Palestinian flag? Why are they so worried about an American student who has an Arab name and Palestinian descent coming to study in the Hebrew University and detain her and keep her out, as they're doing right now? Why are they so worried about, you know, retired people who come in as part of church groups to volunteer and help Palestinians in Hebron? Why are they worried about all these things if they are such a bit with, and at the same time, they have such a big, strong army? They have a severe case of deep insecurity because they know that they have no legitimacy.
Right.
They know that they have no right to be and to do what they do. And so that's why they behave, I believe, the way they do.
So I guess speaking on that insecurity, Israel was created in the wake of the European Holocaust of Jews to be a safe haven for Jewish refugees. But at the same time, these efforts to provide safety and a refuge for one group of people has come at the expense of the Palestinians. So this has also probably contributed to the insecurity of not feeling like they have a secure home. But how, in your experience, is this historical experience of surviving the Holocaust used by Israel to justify and promote their takeover of land?
Well, the state of Israel was not created. They claim the state of Israel is the answer to the Holocaust, but the Zionist movement, the Zionist occupation, the Zionist plans to occupy, not the occupation, but the plans to occupy and take over Palestine had been in place long before the Holocaust. So the Holocaust perhaps gave it a boost, but it certainly was not the reason for creation of the State of Israel. And then what happened after the Holocaust, even though, again, they're trying to pretend that it's some kind of a safe haven for Jews, the vast majority of Holocaust survivors didn't come. And so the State of Israel was left kind of hanging there, where the very people who you would think would want this so-called safe haven turned their back on it. Only a very small fraction of Holocaust survivors actually went to Palestine, and then, you know, which later on became Israel and became Israelis. And many of those that did go actually eventually left because, number one, they were treated very poorly. And number two, they realized that they ended up in a very racist state. So they didn't want that. So the State of Israel ended up having this myth, which it still, you know, maintains today, which is that Israel is a safe haven and it is created so that there won't be another Holocaust and so forth. But the vast majority of Jews have not accepted it. The vast majority of Holocaust survivors have not accepted it. Hmm. So it's really a false claim. And as one gentleman I was talking to from the ultra-Orthodox community, the Haredi community in the UK, who many of whom are descendants of Holocaust survivors, he said, you know, I've been living in the UK almost 40 years. I don't even know what a soldier looks like. Kid who grows up in Israel knows what has seen a soldier. So how could they possibly say that Israel is safe or more safe for Jews than, say, England? You know, that the very claim is false.
And also, there are, you know, Ethiopian Jews and Yemeni Jews, you know, that go to Israel and aren't treated as an equal citizen, you know, merely because of the color of their skin, or they're just not European, but they're still Jewish. So the idea that any Jew is welcome in Israel because of the safe haven is obviously not, it's not an equal opportunity.
No, it's a racist society. And it's a state that was founded on a racist ideology. Zionism is a racist Eurocentric ideology. And so, of course, the Jews that came from Arab countries were treated terribly, and they had to go through a very fast process of changing their accent and changing their manners and changing their clothing and changing everything about them so that hopefully in several generations later they would speak and look more like me, for example, you know, European, white, and so forth. And they were treated terribly, and they, of course, and then the Ethiopians, of course, they're black, you know, African black, so of course they are treated terribly as well. But there's no reason to surprise, because this is a racist society, and again, a state that was founded on a racist ideology.
Mm-hmm. So switching gears, one of the Israeli policies we're talking about this week here in Portland, with the visit of former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, is the long-standing policy of illegal assassinations of Palestinians. Do you think that you could talk about this policy, how it's been used, and Barak's role in promoting it?
Well, political assassinations have been part of Zionist legacy since before the State of Israel was established. I think the very first assassination, if I'm not mistaken, was carried out by the Haganah, which was the Zionist militia, in 1924 in Jerusalem, when they assassinated Jacob Dahan. Jacob Dahan was an ultra-Orthodox Jewish journalist who originally came from Holland, and he opposed Zionism, as did the entire world of Orthodox Jews at that time. And he was on his way from Jerusalem to go to the UK to try to convince people in the UK to rescind the Balfour Declaration. He was a pretty influential guy, and Haganah assassinated him in Jerusalem the night before he left. Then in 1933, there was another political assassination, and then on and on and on. This is against Jews. Then in 1948, in September of 1948, they assassinated Count Bernadotte, who came as an emissary, a United Nations emissary, to try to promote some kind of an agreement between this new state of Israel and the Palestinians. They didn't like him. He was assassinated. And on and on and on. And then, of course, the Mossad began assassinating, and the Israeli military intelligence began assassinating Palestinians. So there's a long history of political assassinations. Of course, Palestinians had suffered the most from this. Ehud Barak was the commander of a murderous unit called Sayeret Matkal, which is supposedly the most prestigious of Israel's assassination units, or what they call special forces units. And as part of that, he participated in a great many and commanded a great many of these assassinations and murders. And course, the Mossad, which is a separate entity, did the same. And the people of Portland should demand that this man be arrested immediately and put on trial for war crimes. Of course, later on, he was, you know, Israel Army Chief of Staff, and he was Defense Minister. And so he is a man who's responsible for a great many war crimes. And if he's not being at least arrested, at least there should be massive protests against this man coming to visit.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. There was actually a book that just came out called Rise and Kill First by Ronan Bergman, I believe is his name. And it, you know, talks all about Israeli assassinations of Palestinians. And one of the reviews is written by Ehud Barak, and he is essentially praising this book, saying, you know, Israel had no choice but to carry out these assassinations for the security of the state of Israel. And it was just interesting to me because I was going to use that book as a source for the show. But then I read reviews that said that Netanyahu and Barak and other Israeli politicians were cooperative in the writing of this book. And so do you have any opinions about that? Do you think that it's kind of promoting this idea that Israel is the victim? And whether they like it or not, they need to carry out these assassinations in order to protect Israel.
Well, that's it. That's exactly that's the argument that they have. You know, it's like, well, you know, maybe it's a terrible thing, but look, we got to do to survive, you know, which is, of course, a complete lie. But this is how they justify all of their crimes. They look at, you know, they kill innocent civilians in Gaza and they say, yes, but we have no choice because of Hamas. This is the line that Israel uses all the time in order to justify its most heinous crimes. And I don't know, there was also a movie, a documentary called The Gatekeepers a few years ago. It had the former heads of the Shabak, which is the Israeli secret police. And they talk about terrible crimes they committed, and they say the same thing. They say, oh, well, we had no choice. What we really wanted was peace. But, of course, you know, it wasn't possible, so we had to resort to doing all these terrible things. And, you know, and they shed a tear. But it's complete nonsense. So they take a great sense of pride when they tell these stories. I've seen interviews with Barak where he describes this raid, I believe it was 1972, if I'm not mistaken, where they raided Beirut and he was dressed as a woman and they entered the home of Palestinian leaders and murdered them in their sleep, in their beds. And they talk about it with great pride. They think it's a wonderful thing. They don't think that there's any value to Palestinian life, and they don't think there's anything wrong in doing what they did. And at the end, which is the existence of this racist apartheid state, justifies the means, which is the killing of Palestinians, whether it's Palestinian children in Gaza or Palestinian leaders in Beirut or Palestinian writers like Hassan Kanafani. I mean, they don't distinguish between any of them. To them, it's something that they need to do, and they're fine with it. But yeah, that's exactly the spirit of the book, is that it's done as though this is heroism.
Right. So to wrap up, I can't help but wonder, do you see any hope for a future Palestine? You know, hope for a one-state solution with one person, one vote?
I do. I mean, the short answer is yes. A single state over all of Palestine already exists. Israel created a single state over all of Palestine, and it's called the State of Israel, and it's an apartheid racist state. That's the reality in Palestine today. Now, there are two options. One is to support it, and one is to oppose it. And that has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with our values. If we believe in racism and violence and are willing to support it and legitimize it, then we call the country Israel and we move on. If we reject and are not willing to legitimize racism and violence, institutionalized racism and violence, then we, first of all, must not call the country Israel. We must call it by its name, which is Palestine. We must support the struggle of Palestinian people to equality, to the right of return, to ending the military regime that exists and in various forms that under which Palestinians live. And then if we act, then there is a chance, of course, a very good chance, that the Zionist regime will fall and Palestine will be free. I think the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, is, if not the best, certainly one of the best tools that we have. I think it's something that everybody should be part of. I think it's everybody should engage in and encourage their friends and their family members to engage in and participate in and vocally and actively boycott everything and anything from, you know, agriculture products to computer products to visits by people like Ehud Barak to cultural and academic collaboration with Israel can bring down this regime.
So you agree that there should be cultural and academic boycotts against Israel?
Oh, absolutely.
Really? Okay.
Be complete and absolute, without a doubt. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's interesting. We had at U of O, we passed a BDS resolution, and it got a lot of backlash from the Jewish community on campus. And their main argument, which, you know, we were only boycotting products like Sabra and HP and Motorola, but they said we can't agree with this because we can't support the boycott of cultural and academic institutions, which we weren't. But that was their main focus, which I don't know. I'm kind of torn.
It was their main focus. If you know what I mean, they would have been against it anyway, because the Zionist approach is not to boycott. You know, the arguments that I hear against a cultural or against a academic boycott is that culture and the academia is where people can meet and exchange ideas and they're a little more progressive. Well, where are the signs? I don't see signs of either academia or cultural figures in Israel standing up against the siege in Gaza. I don't see them demanding that the people in the Negev Desert, the Palestinians, hundreds of thousands of them, who are denied water and denied services, get water and services. I don't see them coming out against child detention and the thousands of political prisoners that Israel holds. I do not see that. Academia and cultural figures in Israel are complacent at best, and they are part of the occupation, and they participate willingly in the occupation and in the oppression. There's absolutely no argument, and there's no evidence at all that can justify excluding them or excluding any part of Israeli society or the state of Israel from the boycott. I think the academic, the cultural boycott, and every other fashion of boycott, divestment, and sanctions are legitimate and absolutely must be observed.
Thank you. Thank you for that. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Again, that was Miko Peled, Israeli peace activist, author, and advocate of Palestinian human rights. On today's show, you heard songs Now by Miguel and Checkpoint by Jasiri X. If you missed any part of this show, it's archived on our website at kboo.fm/onelandmanyvoices. Thanks for listening.
Times, tales from the dark side, evidence of the settlements on my hard drive. Man, I swear my heart died at the end of that car ride. When I saw that checkpoint, welcome to apartheid. Soldiers wear military green at the checkpoint. Automatic guns, that's machine at the checkpoint. Tables not M16s at the checkpoint. Fingers on the trigger, you'll get leaned at the checkpoint. Little children, grown adults and teens at the checkpoint. All your papers better be clean at the checkpoint. Gotta put your finger on the screen at the checkpoint. And pray that red light turns green at the checkpoint.